This is Audible.
Audible Frontiers presents The Crystal Shard, written by R.A. Salvatore, narrated by Victor Bavine. Prelude. The demon sat back on the seat it had carved in the stem of the giant mushroom. Sludge slurped and rolled around the rock island, the eternal oozing and shifting that marked this layer of the abyss. Ertu drummed its clawed fingers, its horned, ape-like head lolling about on its shoulders as it peered into the gloom.
"Where are you, Telchaz?"
the demon hissed, expecting news of the relic. Crenshinabon pervaded all of the demon's thoughts. With the shard in its grasp, Ertu could rise over an entire layer, maybe even several layers. And Ertu had come so close to possessing it. The demon knew the power of the artifact. Ertu had been serving 7 liches when they combined their evil magics and made the crystal shard. The liches, undead spirits of powerful wizards that refused to rest when their mortal bodies had passed from the realms of the living, had gathered to create the most vile artifact ever made. An evil that fed and flourished off of that which the purveyors of good considered most precious, the light of the sun. But they had gone beyond even their own considerable powers. The forging actually consumed the 7, Crenshinabon stealing the magical strength that preserved the lich's undead state to fuel its own first flickers of life. The ensuing bursts of power had hurtled Ertu back to the abyss, and the demon had presumed the shard destroyed. But Crenshinabon would not be so easily destroyed. Now, centuries later, Ertu had stumbled upon the trail of the crystal shard again. A crystal tower, Kryshal Tirith, with a pulsating heart, the exact image of Crenshinabon. Ertu knew the magic was close by. The demon could sense the powerful presence of the relic. If only it could have found the thing earlier, if only it could have grasped. But then Aldemenira had arrived, an angelic being of tremendous power. Aldemenira banished Ertu back to the abyss with a single word. Ertu peered through the swirling smoke and gloom when it heard the sucking footsteps.
"Telchaz!" the demon bellowed.
"Yes, my master,"
the smaller demon answered, cowering as it approached the mushroom throne.
"Did he get it?" Ertu roared. "Does Aldemenira have the crystal shard?"
Telchaz quivered and whimpered.
"Yes, my lord. No, my lord."
Ertu's evil red eyes narrowed.
"He could not destroy it,"
the little demon was quick to explain.
"Crenshinabon burned his hands."
"Huh?"
Ertu snorted.
"Beyond even the power of Aldemenira. Where is it, then? Did you bring it? Or does it remain in the 2nd crystal tower?"
Telchaz whimpered again. It didn't want to tell its cruel master the truth, but it would not dare to disobey.
"No, master, not in the tower,"
the little demon whispered.
"No!" Ertu roared. "Where is it?"
"Aldemenira threw it."
"Threw it?"
"Across the plains, merciful master,"
Telchaz cried, with all of his strength.
"Across the very plains of existence," Ertu growled.
"I tried to stop him, but..."
The horned head shot forward. Telchaz's words gurgled indecipherably as Ertu's canine maw tore its throat out. Far removed from the gloom of the abyss, Crenshinabon came to rest upon the world. Far up in the northern mountains of Faerun, the crystal shard, the ultimate perversion, settled into the snow of a bowl-shaped dell, and waited. Part 1. 10 Towns. If I could choose what life would be mine, it would be this life that I now have at this time. I am at peace, and yet the world around me swirls with turmoil, with the ever-present threat of barbarian raids and goblin wars, with tundra yetis and gigantic polar worms. The reality of existence here in Icewind Dale is harsh indeed, an environment unforgiving, where one mistake will cost you your life. That is the joy of the place, the very edge of disaster, and not because of treachery, as I knew in my home of Menzo Berenzon. I can accept the risks of Icewind Dale. I can revel in them and use them to keep my warrior instincts finely honed. I can use them to remind me every day of the glory and joy of life. There is no complacency here, in this place where safety cannot be taken for granted, where a turn of the wind can pile snow over your head, where a single misstep on a boat can put you into water that will steal your breath away and render muscles useless in mere seconds, or a simple lapse on the tundra can put you in the belly of a fierce yeti. When you live with death so close, you come to appreciate life all the more. And when you share that life with friends like those that I have come to know these last years, then you know paradise. Never could I have imagined in my years in Menzo Berenzon, or in the wilds of the Underdark, or even when I first came to the surface world, that I would ever surround myself with such friends as these. They are of different races, all three, and all three different from my own, and yet they are more alike what is in my heart than anyone I have ever known, save perhaps my father Zacnaphane and the ranger Montolio, who trained me in the ways of Mieliki. I have met many folk up here in Ten Towns, in the savage land of Icewind Dale, who accept me despite my dark elf heritage, and yet these three, above all others, have become as family to me. Why them? Why Brunner, Regis, and Catti Bree above all others, three friends whom I treasure as much as Guinevere, my companion for all these years? Everyone knows Brunner as blunt. That is the trademark of many dwarves, but in Brunner the trait runs pure. Or so he wants all to believe. I know better. I know the other side of Brunner, the hidden side, that soft and warm place. Yes, he has a heart, though he tries hard to bury it. He is blunt, yes, particularly with criticism. He speaks of errors without apology and without judgment, simply telling the honest truth and leaving it up to the offender to correct, or not correct, the situation. Brunner never allows tact or empathy to get in the way of his telling the world how it can be better. But that is only half of the tale concerning the dwarf. On the other side of the coin, he is far from blunt. Concerning compliments, Brunner is not dishonest, just quiet. Perhaps that is why I love him. I see in him Icewind Dale itself, cold and harsh and unforgiving, but ultimately honest. He keeps me at my best all the time, and in doing that, he helps me to survive in this place. There is only one Icewind Dale, and only one Brunner Battlehammer, and if ever I met a creature and a land created for each other. Conversely, Regis stands, or more appropriately, reclines, as a reminder to me of the goals and rewards of a job well done. Not that Regis is ever the one who does that job. Regis reminds me, and Brunner, I would guess, that there is more to life than responsibility, that there are times for personal relaxation and enjoyment of the rewards brought about by good work and vigilance. He is too soft for the tundra, too round in the belly and too slow on his feet. His fighting skills are lacking, and he could not track a herd of caribou on fresh snow. Yet he survives, even thrives up here, with wit and attitude, with an understanding, better than Brunner, surely, and even better than my own, of how to appease and please those around him, of how to anticipate, rather than just react to the moves of others. Regis knows more than just what people do. He knows why they do it. And that ability to understand motivation allowed him to see past the color of my skin and the reputation of my people. If Brunner is honest in expressing his observations, then Regis is honest in following the course of his heart. And finally, there is Catty Bree. Wonderful and so full of life. Catty Bree is the opposite side of the same coin to me, a different reasoning to reach the same conclusions. We are soulmates who see and judge different things in the world to arrive at the same place. Perhaps we thus validate each other. Perhaps in seeing Catty Bree arriving at the same place as myself, and knowing that she arrived there along a different road, tells me that I followed my heart truly. Is that it? Do I trust her more than I trust myself? That question is neither indictment of my feelings nor any self-incrimination. We share beliefs about the way of the world and the way the world should be. She is akin to my heart, as is Mieliki. And if I found my goddess by looking honestly into my own heart, then so I have found my dearest friend and ally. They are with me, all three. And Guinevere, dear Guinevere as well. I am living in a land of stark beauty and stark reality, a place where you have to be wary and alert and at your very best at all times. I call this paradise. Drizzt Do'Urden. 1. The Stooge. When the wizard's caravan from the host tower of the Arcane saw the snow-capped peak of Kelvin's cairn rising from the flat horizon, they were more than a little relieved. The hard journey from Luskin to the remote frontier settlement known as Ten Towns had taken them more than 3 10-days. The first 10-day hadn't been too difficult. The troop held close to the Sword Coast, and though they were traveling along the northernmost reaches of the realms, the summer breezes blowing in off the trackless sea were comfortable enough. But when they rounded the westernmost spurs of the spine of the world, the mountain range that many considered the northern boundary of civilization, and turned into Icewind Dale, the wizards quickly understood why they had been advised against making this journey. Icewind Dale, 1,000 square miles of barren, broken tundra, had been described to them as one of the most unwelcoming lands in all the realms, and within a single day of traveling on the northern side of the spine of the world, Eldiluc, Dendibar the Mottled, and the other wizards from Luskin considered the reputation well-earned. Bordered by impassable mountains on the south, an expanding glacier on the east, and an unnavigable sea of countless icebergs on the north and west, Icewind Dale was attainable only through the pass between the spine of the world and the coast, a trail rarely used by any but the most hardy of merchants. For the rest of their lives, two memories would ring clear in the wizards' minds whenever they thought about this trip. Two facts of life on Icewind Dale that travelers here never forgot. The first was the endless moaning of the wind, as though the land itself was continuously groaning in torment, and the second was the emptiness of the dale, mile after mile of gray and brown horizon lines. The caravan's destination marked the only varying features in all the dale. 10 small towns positioned around the 3 lakes of the region under the shadow of the only mountain, Kelvin's Cairn. Like everyone else who came to this harsh land, the wizard sought 10 towns Scrimshaw, the fine ivory carvings made from the head bones of the knucklehead trout which swam in the waters of the lakes. Some of the wizards, though, had even more devious gains in mind. The man marveled at how easily the slender dagger slipped through the folds in the older man's robe and then cut deeper into the wrinkled flesh. Mordecai the Red turned on his apprentice, his eyes locked into a widened, amazed set at the betrayal by the man he had raised as his own son for a quarter of a century. Akar Kessel let go of the dagger and backed away from his master, horrified that the mortally wounded man was still standing. He ran out of distance for his retreat, stumbling into the rear wall of the small cabin the Wizards of Luskan had been given as temporary quarters by the host city of Easthaven. Kessel trembled visibly, pondering the grisly consequences he would face in light of the growing possibility that the magical expertise of the old mage had found a way to defeat even death itself. What terrible fate would his mighty mentor impose upon him for his betrayal? What magical torments could a true and powerful wizard such as Mordecai conjure that would outdo the most agonizing of the tortures common throughout the land? The old man held his gaze firmly on Akar Kessel, even as the last light began to fade from his dying eyes. He didn't ask why. He didn't even outwardly question Kessel about the possible motives. The gain of power was involved somewhere, he knew. That was always the case in such betrayals. What confused him was the instrument, not the motive. Kessel? How could Kessel, the bumbling apprentice whose stuttering lips could barely call out the simplest of cantrips, possibly hope to profit from the death of the only man who had ever shown him more than basic polite consideration? Mordecai the Red fell dead. It was one of the few questions he had never found the answer to. Kessel remained against the wall, needing its tangible support, and continued to shake for long minutes. Gradually, the confidence that had put him in this dangerous position began to grow again within him. He was the boss now. Eldiluc, Dendibar the Mottled, and the other wizards who had made the trip had said so. With his master gone, he, Akar Kessel, would be rightfully awarded his own meditation chamber and alchemy lab in the host tower of the Arcane in Luskan. Eldiluc, Dendibar the Mottled, and the others had said so.
"It is done, then?"
the burly man asked when Kessel entered the dark alley designated as the meeting place. Kessel nodded eagerly.
"The red-robed wizard of Luskan shan't cast again now," he proclaimed too loudly for the likes of his fellow conspirators.
"Speak quietly, fool,"
Dendibar the Mottled, a frail-looking man tucked defensively within the alleyway's shadows, demanded in the same monotonous voice that he always used. Dendibar rarely spoke at all, and never displayed any semblance of passion when he did. Ever was he hidden beneath the low-pulled cowl of his robe. There was something cold-blooded about Dendibar that unnerved most people who met him. Though the wizard was physically the smallest and least imposing man on the merchant caravan that had made the 400-mile journey to the frontier settlement of Ten Towns, Kessel feared him more than any of the others.
"Mordecai the Red, my former master, is dead,"
Kessel reiterated softly.
"Akar Kessel, this day forward, known as Kessel the Red, is now appointed to the Wizards Guild of Luskar."
"Easy, friend,"
said Eldiluc, putting a comforting hand on Kessel's nervously twitching shoulder.
"There will be time for a proper coronation when we return to the city."
He smiled and winked at Dendibar from behind Kessel's head. Kessel's mind was whirling, lost in a daydream search through all of the ramifications of his pending appointment. Never again would he be taunted by the other apprentices, boys much younger than he, who climbed through the ranks in the guild step by tedious step. They would show him some respect now, for he would leap beyond even those who had passed him by in the earliest days of his apprenticeship into the honorable position of wizard. As his thoughts probed every detail of the coming days, though, Kessel's radiant face suddenly grayed over. He turned sharply on the man at his side, his features tensed, as though he had discovered a terrible error. Elder Luke and several of the others in the alley became uneasy. They all fully understood the consequences if the Archmage of the Host Tower of the Arcane ever learned of their murderous deed.
"The robe?"
Kessel asked.
"Should I have brought the red robe?"
Elder Luke couldn't contain his relieved chuckle, but Kessel merely took it as a comforting gesture from his newfound friend.
"I should have known that something so trivial would throw him into such a fit," Elder Luke told himself, but to Kessel he merely said,
"Have no fear about it. There are plenty of robes in the Host Tower. It would seem a bit suspicious, would it not, if you showed up at the Archmage's doorstep, claiming the vacated seat of Mordecai the Red, and holding the very garment that the murdered wizard was wearing when he was slain?"
Kessel thought about it for a moment, then agreed.
"Perhaps," Elder Luke continued, "you should not wear the red robe."
Kessel's eyes squinted in panic. His old self-doubts, which had haunted him for all of his days since his childhood, began to bubble up within him. What was Elder Luke saying? Were they going to change their minds and not award him the seat he had rightfully earned? Elder Luke had used the ambiguity of his statement as a tease, but he didn't want to push Kessel into a dangerous state of doubt. With a second wink at Dendibar, who was inwardly thoroughly enjoying this game, he answered the poor wretch's unspoken question.
"I only meant that perhaps a different color would better suit you. Blue would complement your eyes."
Kessel cackled in relief.
"Perhaps,"
he agreed, his fingers nervously twiddling. Dendibar suddenly grew tired of the farce. He motioned for his burly companion to be rid of the annoying little wretch. Elder Luke obediently led Kessel back down the alleyway.
"Go on now back to the stables," he instructed. "Tell the master there that the wizards shall be leaving for Luskin this very night." "But what of the body?"
Kessel asked. Elder Luke smiled evilly.
"Leave it. That cabin is reserved for visiting merchants and dignitaries from the south. It will most probably remain vacant until next spring. Another murder in this part of the world will cause little excitement, I assure you, and even if the good people of East Haven were to decipher what had truly happened, they are wise enough to tend to their own business and leave the affairs of wizards to wizards."
The group from Luskin moved out into the waning sunlight on the street.
"Now be off," Elder Luke commanded. "Look for us as the sun sets."
He watched as Kessel, like some elated little boy, scurried away.
"How fortunate to find so convenient a tool," Dendibar noted. "The wizard's stupid apprentice saved us much trouble. I doubt that we would have found a way to get at that crafty old one. Though the gods alone know why ever did Mordecai have a soft spot for his wretched little apprentice."
"Soft enough for a dagger's point," laughed a second voice.
"And so convenient a setting," remarked yet another. "Unexplained bodies are considered no more than an inconvenience to the cleaning wenches in this uncivilized outpost."
The burly Elder Luke laughed aloud. The gruesome task was at last completed. They could, finally, leave this barren stretch of frozen desert and return home. Kessel's step was sprightly as he made his way across the village of East Haven to the barn where the wizard's horses had been stabled. He felt as though becoming a wizard would change every aspect of his daily life, as if some mystical strength had somehow been infused into his previously incompetent talents. He tingled in anticipation of the power that would be his. An alley cat crossed before him, casting him a wary glance as it pranced by. Slit-eyed, Kessel looked around to see if anyone was watching.
"Why not?"
he muttered. Pointing a deadly finger at the cat, he uttered the command words to call forth a burst of energy. The nervous feline bolted away at the spectacle, but no magical bolt struck it, or even near it.
Kessel looked down at his singed fingertip and wondered what he had done wrong. But he wasn't overly dismayed. His own blackened nail was the strongest effect he had ever gotten from that particular spell. 2. On the Banks of Mare Dualden. Regis the Halfling, the only one of his kind for hundreds of miles in any direction, locked his fingers behind his head and leaned back against the mossy blanket of the tree trunk. Regis was short, even by the standards of his diminutive race, with the fluff of his curly brown locks barely cresting the 3-foot mark. But his belly was amply thickened by his love of a good meal, or several, as the opportunities presented themselves. The crooked stick that served as his fishing pole rose up above him, clenched between two of his furry toes, and hung out over the quiet lake, mirrored perfectly in the glassy surface of Mare Dualden. Gentle ripples rolled down the image as the red-painted wooden bobber began to dance slightly. The line had floated in toward shore and hung limply in the water, so Regis couldn't feel the fish nibbling at the bait. In seconds, the hook was cleaned with no catch to show for it, but the halfling didn't know, and it would be hours before he'd even bother to check. Not that he'd have cared, anyway. This trip was for leisure, not work. With winter coming on, Regis figured that this might well be his last excursion of the year to the lake. He didn't go in for winter fishing like some of the fanatically greedy humans of Ten Towns. Besides, the halfling already had enough ivory stocked up from other people's catches to keep him busy for all 7 months of snow. He was truly a credit to his less than ambitious race, carving out a bit of civilization in a land where none existed, hundreds of miles from the most remote settlement that could rightly be called a city. Other halflings never came this far north, even during the summer months, preferring the comfort of the southern climes. Regis, too, would have gladly packed up his belongings and returned to the south, except for a little problem he had with a certain guildmaster of a prominent thieves' guild. A 4-inch block of the white gold lay beside the reclining halfling, along with several delicate carving instruments. The beginnings of a horse's muzzle marred the squareness of the block. Regis had meant to work on the piece while he was fishing. Regis meant to do a lot of things.
"Too fine a day," he had rationalized, an excuse that never seemed to grow stale for him. This time, though, unlike so many others, it truly bore credibility. It seemed as though the weather demons that bent this harsh land to their iron will had taken a holiday, or perhaps they were just gathering their strength for a brutal winter. The result was an autumn day fitting for the civilized lands to the south. A rare day indeed for the land that had come to be called Icewind Dale, a name well earned by the eastern breezes that always seemed to blow in, bringing with them the chilled air of Reghead Glacier. Even on the few days that the wind shifted, there was little relief, for Ten Towns was bordered on the north and west by miles of empty tundra and then more ice, the sea of moving ice. Only southern breezes promised any relief, and any wind that tried to reach this desolate area from that direction was usually blocked by the high peaks of the spine of the world. Regis managed to keep his eyes open for a while, peering up through the fuzzy limbs of the fir trees at the puffy white clouds as they sailed across the sky on the mild breezes. The sun rained down golden warmth, and the halfling was tempted now and then to take off his waistcoat. Whenever a cloud blocked out the warming rays, though, Regis was reminded that it was Elaint on the tundra. In a month there would be snow. In 2, the roads west and south to Luskin, the nearest city to Ten Towns, would be impassable to any but the sturdy or the stupid. Regis looked across the long bay that rolled in around the side of his little fishing hole. The rest of Ten Towns was taking advantage of the weather, too. The fishing boats were out in force, scrambling and weaving around each other to find their special hitting spots. No matter how many times he witnessed it, the greed of humans always amazed Regis. Back in the southern land of Kalimshan, the halfling had been climbing a fast ladder to associate guildmaster in one of the most prominent thieves' guilds in the port city of Kalimport. But as he saw it, human greed had cut short his career.
His guildmaster, the Pasha Pook, possessed a wonderful collection of rubies, a dozen at least, whose facets were so ingeniously cut that they seemed to cast an almost hypnotic spell on anyone who viewed them. Regis had marveled at the scintillating stones whenever Pook put them out on display, and after all, he'd only taken one. To this day, the halfling couldn't figure out why the Pasha, who had no less than 11 others, was still so angry with him.
"Alas for the greed of humans,"
Regis would say, whenever the Pasha's men showed up in another town that the halfling had made his home, forcing him to extend his exile to an even more remote land. But he hadn't needed that phrase for a year and a half now, not since he had arrived in Ten Towns. Pook's arms were long, but this frontier settlement, in the middle of the most inhospitable and untamed land imaginable, was a longer way still, and Regis was quite content in the security of his new sanctuary. There was wealth here, and for those nimble and talented enough to be a scrimshander, someone who could transform the ivory-like bone of a knucklehead trout into an artistic carving, a comfortable living could be made with a minimum amount of work. Along with Ten Towns' Scrimshaw fast becoming the rave of the South, the halfling meant to shake off his customary lethargy and turn his newfound trade into a booming business. Someday. Drizzt O'Urden trotted along silently, his soft, low-cut boots barely stirring the dust. He kept the cowl of his brown cloak pulled low over the flowing waves of his stark white hair, and moved with such effortless grace that an onlooker might have thought him to be no more than an illusion, an optical trick of the brown sea of tundra. The dark elf pulled his cloak tighter about him. He felt as vulnerable in the sunlight as a human would in the dark of night. More than half a century of living many miles below ground had not been erased by several years on the sunlit surface. To this day, sunlight drained and dizzied him. But Drizzt had traveled right through the night and was compelled to continue. Already he was overdue for his meeting with Brunner in the Dwarf's Valley, and he had seen the signs. The reindeer had begun their autumn migration southwest to the sea, yet no human track followed the herd. The caves north of Ten Towns, always a stopover for the nomadic barbarians on their way back to the tundra, had not even been stocked to reprovision the tribes on their long trek. Drizzt understood the implications. In normal barbarian life, the survival of the tribes depended on their following the reindeer herd. The apparent abandonment of their traditional ways was more than a little disturbing. And Drizzt had heard the battle drums. Their subtle rumblings rolled over the empty plain like distant thunder, in patterns usually recognizable only to the other barbarian tribes. But Drizzt knew what they foretold. He was an observer who understood the value of knowledge of friend or foe, and he had often used his stealth prowess to observe the daily routines and traditions of the proud natives of Icewind Dale, the barbarians. Drizzt picked up his pace, pushing himself to the limits of his endurance. In 5 short years he had come to care for the cluster of villages known as Ten Towns and for the people who lived there. Like so many of the other outcasts who had finally settled there, the drow had found no welcome anywhere else in the realms. Even here he was only tolerated by most, but in the unspoken kinship of fellow rogues, few people bothered him. He'd been luckier than most. He'd found a few friends who could look beyond his heritage and see his true character. Anxiously, the dark elf squinted at Calvin's Cairn, the solitary mountain that marked the entrance to the rocky dwarven valley between Mare Dualden and Lac Dinashir. But his violet-colored almond eyes, marvelous orbs that could rival an owl's in the night, could not penetrate the blur of daylight enough to gauge the distance. Again he ducked his head under the cowl, preferring a blind run to the dizziness of prolonged exposure to the sun, and sank back into the dark dreams of Menzo Berenzon, the lightless underworld city of his ancestors. The drow elves had actually once walked on the surface world, dancing beneath the sun and the stars with their fair-skinned cousins. Yet the dark elves were malicious, passionless killers beyond the tolerance of even their normally unjudging kin.
and in the inevitable war of the elven nations, the drow were driven into the bowels of the ground. Here they found a world of dark secrets and dark magics, and were content to remain. Over the centuries, they had flourished and grown strong once more, attuning themselves to the ways of mysterious magics. They became more powerful than even their surface-dwelling cousins, whose dealings with the arcane arts under the life-giving warmth of the sun were hobby, not necessity. As a race, though, the drow had lost all desire to see the sun and the stars. Both their bodies and minds had adapted to the depths, and luckily for all who dwelt under the open sky, the evil dark elves were content to remain where they were, only occasionally resurfacing to raid and pillage. As far as Driz knew, he was the only one of his kind living on the surface. He had learned some tolerance of the light, but he still suffered the hereditary weaknesses it imparted upon his kind. Yet even considering his disadvantage under daytime conditions, Drizzt was outraged by his own carelessness when the two bear-like tundra yetis, their camouflaging coats of shaggy fur still colored in summer brown, suddenly rose up before him. A red flag rose from the deck of one of the fishing boats, signaling a catch. Regis watched as it moved higher and higher.
"A four-footer or better,"
the halfling mumbled approvingly when the flag topped out just below the mast's crosspiece.
"There'll be singing in one house tonight."
A second ship raced up beside the one that had signaled the catch, banging into the anchored vessel in its rush. The two crews immediately drew weapons and faced off, though each remained on its respective ship. With nothing between him and the boats but empty water, Regis clearly heard the shouts of the captains.
"Ere ye stole me catch!"
the captain of the second ship roared.
"You're water-weary,"
the captain of the first ship retorted.
"Never it was. It's our fish fairly hooked and fairly hauled. Now be gone with your stinking tub before we take you out of the water."
Predictably, the crew of the second ship was over the rail and swinging before the captain of the first ship had finished speaking. Regis turned his eyes back to the clouds. The dispute on the boats did not hold any interest for him, though the noises of the battle were certainly disturbing. Such squabbles were common on the lakes, always over the fish, especially if someone landed a big one. Generally, they weren't too serious, more bluster and parrying than actual fighting, and only rarely did someone get badly wounded or killed. There were exceptions, though. In one skirmish involving no less than 17 boats, 3 full crews and half of a fourth were cut down and left floating in the bloodied water. On that same day, that particular lake, the southernmost of the 3, had its name changed from Delanloon to Redwaters.
"Ah, little fishes, what trouble you bring,"
Regis muttered softly, pondering the irony of the havoc the silvery fish wreaked on the lives of the greedy people of 10 towns. These 10 communities owed their very existence to the knucklehead trout, with their oversized, fist-shaped heads and bones the consistency of fine ivory. The 3 lakes were the only spots in the world where the valuable fish were known to swim, and though the region was barren and wild, overrun with humanoids and barbarians and sporting frequent storms that could flatten the sturdiest of buildings, the lure of quick wealth brought in people from the farthest reaches of the realms. As many inevitably left as came in, though, Icewind Dale was a bleak, colorless wasteland of merciless weather and countless dangers. Death was a common visitor to the villagers, stalking any who could not face the harsh realities of Icewind Dale. Still, the towns had grown considerably in the century that had passed since the knuckleheads were first discovered. Initially, the 9 villages on the lake were no more than the shanties where individual frontiersmen had staked out a claim on a particularly good fishing hole. The 10th village, Bryn Shander, though now a walled, bustling settlement of several thousand people, had been merely an empty hill sporting a solitary cabin where the fishermen would meet once a year, exchanging stories and goods with the traders from Luskin. Back in the early days of 10 towns, a boat, even a one-man rowboat out on the lakes, whose waters year-round were cold enough to kill in minutes anyone unfortunate enough to fall overboard, was a rare sight. But now every town on the lakes had a fleet of sailing vessels flying its flag. Targos alone, largest of the fishing towns, could put over 100 vessels onto Mare Dualden, some of them 2-masted schooners with crews of 10 or more.
A death cry sounded from the embattled ships, and the clang of steel on steel rang out loudly. Regis wondered, and not for the first time, if the people of Ten Towns would be better off without the troublesome fish. The halfling had to admit that Ten Towns had been a haven for him, though. His practiced, nimble fingers adapted easily to the instruments of the Scrimshander, and he had even been elected as the council spokesman of one of the villages. Granted, Lonelywood was the smallest and northernmost of the Ten Towns, a place where the rogues of rogues hid out, but Regis still considered his appointment an honor. It was convenient as well. As the only true Scrimshander in Lonelywood, Regis was the sole person in the town with reason to desire or travel regularly to Bryn Shander, the principal settlement and market hub of Ten Towns. This had proved to be quite a boon to the halfling. He became the primary courier to bring the catches of Lonelywood's fishermen to market, for a commission equaling a tenth piece of the goods. This alone kept him deep enough in ivory to make an easy living. Once a month during the summer season, and once every three in the winter, weather permitting, Regis had to attend council meetings and fulfill his duties as spokesman. These meetings took place in Bryn Shander, and though they normally broke down into nothing more than petty arguments over fishing territories between villages, they usually lasted only a few hours. Regis considered his attendance a small price to pay for keeping his monopoly on trips to the southern marketplace. The fighting on the boat soon ended, only one man dead, and Regis drifted back into quiet enjoyment of the sailing clouds. The halfling looked back over his shoulder at the dozens of low wooden cabins dotting the thick rows of trees that comprised Lonelywood. Despite the reputation of its inhabitants, Regis found this town to be the best in the region. The trees provided a measure of protection from the howling wind and good corner posts for the houses. Only its distance from Bryn Shander had kept the town in the wood from being a more prominent member of Ten Towns. Abruptly, Regis pulled the ruby pendant out from under his waistcoat and stared at the wondrous gem he had appropriated from his former master 1,000 miles and more to the south in Kalimport.
"Ah, Pook," he mused, "if only you could see me now."
The elf went for the 2 scimitars sheathed on his hips, but the Yetis closed quickly. Instinctively, Drizzt spun to his left, sacrificing his opposite flank to accept the rush of the closest monster. His right arm became helplessly pinned to his side as the Yeti wrapped its great arms around him, but he managed to keep his left arm free enough to draw his second weapon. Ignoring the pain of the Yeti's squeeze, Drizzt set the hilt of the scimitar firmly against his hip and allowed the momentum of the second charging monster to impale it on the curving blade. In its frenzied death throes, the second Yeti pulled away, taking the scimitar with it. The remaining monster bore Drizzt to the ground under its weight. The drow worked his free hand frantically to keep the deadly teeth from gaining a hold on his throat, but he knew that it was only a matter of time before his stronger foe finished him. Suddenly, Drizzt heard a sharp crack. The Yeti shuddered violently. Its head contorted weirdly, and a gout of blood and brains poured over its face from above its forehead.
"You're late, elf!" came the rough edge of a familiar voice.
Brunner Battlehammer walked up the back of his dead foe, disregarding the fact that the heavy monster lay on top of his elven friend. In spite of the added discomfort, the dwarf's long, pointed, often broken nose and gray-streaked, though still fiery red beard came as a welcome sight to Drizzt.
"No, I'd find ye in trouble if I came out and looked for ye."
Smiling in relief, and also at the mannerisms of the ever-amazing dwarf, Drizzt managed to wriggle out from under the monster while Brunner worked to free his axe from the thick skull.
"Head's as hard as frozen oak," grumbled the dwarf.
He planted his feet behind the Yeti's ears and pulled the axe free with a mighty jerk.
"Where's that kitten of yours, anyway?"
Drizzt fumbled around in his pack for a moment and produced a small onyx statue of a panther. "I'd hardly label Guinevere a kitten," he said with fond reverence. He turned the figurine over in his hands, feeling the intricate details of the work, to ensure that it had not been damaged in the fall under the Yeti.
"Bah, a cat's a cat," insisted the dwarf. "And why isn't it here when you needed it?"
"Even a magical animal needs its rest," Drizzt explained.
"Bah," Brunner spouted again. It's sure to be a sorry day when a drow, and a ranger what's more, gets taken off his guard on an open plain by two scab tundra yetis.
Brunner licked his stained axe blade, then spat in disgust.
Foul beasts, he grumbled. Can't even eat the damn things.
He pounded the axe into the ground to clean the blade and stomped off toward Kelvin's cairn. Drizzt put Gwenevar back into the pack and went to retrieve his scimitar from the other monster.
Come on, elf, scolded the dwarf. We've 5 miles and more of road to go.
Drizzt shook his head and wiped the blood-stained blade on the felled monster's fur. Roll on, Brunner Battlehammer, he whispered under his smile. And know to your pleasure that every monster along our trail will mark well your passing and keep its head safely hidden. 3. The Mead Hall. Many miles north of Ten Towns, across the trackless tundra to the northernmost edge of land in all the realms, the frosts of winter had already hardened the ground in a white-tipped glaze. There were no mountains or trees to block the cold bite of the relentless eastern wind, carrying the frosty air from Raghead Glacier. The great bergs of the Sea of Moving Ice drifted slowly past, the wind howling off of their high riding tips in a grim reminder of the coming season. And yet, the nomadic tribes who summered there with the reindeer had not journeyed with the herd's migration southwest along the coast to the more hospitable sea on the south side of the peninsula. The unwavering flatness of the horizon was broken in one small corner by a solitary encampment, the largest gathering of barbarians this far north in more than a century. To accommodate the leaders of the respective tribes, several deerskin tents had been laid out in a circular pattern, each encompassed in its own ring of campfires. In the center of this circle, a huge deerskin hall had been constructed, designed to hold every warrior of the tribes. The tribesmen called it Hengarot, the Mead Hall, and to the northern barbarians this was a place of reverence, where food and drink were shared in toasts to Tempus, the god of battle. The fires outside the hall burned low this night, for King Hifstag and the tribe of the Elk, the last to arrive, were expected in the camp before moonset. All the barbarians already in the encampment had assembled in Hengarot and begun the pre-council festivities. Great flagons of mead dotted every table, and good-natured contests of strength sprang up with growing frequency. Though the tribes often warred with each other, in Hengarot all differences were put aside. King Beorg, a robust man with tousled blonde locks, a beard fading to white, and lines of experience etched deeply into his tanned face, stood solemnly at the head table. Representing his people, he stood tall and straight, his wide shoulders proudly squared. The barbarians of Icewind Dale stood a full head and more above the average inhabitant of Ten Towns, sprouting as though to take advantage of the wide and roomy expanses of empty tundra. They were indeed much akin to their land. Like the ground they roamed over, their often bearded faces were browned from the sun and cracked by the constant wind, giving them a leathery, toughened appearance, a foreboding, expressionless mask that did not welcome outsiders. They despised the people of Ten Towns, whom they considered weak wealth-chasers possessed of no spiritual value whatsoever. Yet one of those wealth-chasers stood among them now in their most revered hall of meeting. At Beorg's side was de Bernazon, the dark-haired southerner, the only man in the room who was not born and bred of the barbarian tribes. The mousy de Bernazon kept his shoulders defensively hunched as he glanced nervously about the hall. He was well aware that the barbarians were not overly fond of outsiders, and that any one of them, even the youngest attended, could break him in half with a casual flick of his huge hands.
"Hold steady," Beorg instructed the southerner. "Tonight you hoist mead flagons with the tribe of the wolf. If they sense your fear—" He left the rest unspoken. But de Bernazon knew well how the barbarians dealt with weakness. The small man took a steadying deep breath and straightened his shoulders. Yet Beorg, too, was nervous. King Hifstag was his primary rival on the tundra, commanding a force as dedicated, disciplined, and numerous as his own. Unlike the customary barbarian raids,
Beorg's plan called for the total conquest of 10 towns, enslaving the surviving fishermen and living well off of the wealth they harvested from the lakes. Beorg saw an opportunity for his people to abandon their precarious nomadic existence and find a measure of luxury they had never known. Everything now hinged on the ascent of Hiefstag, a brutal king interested only in personal glory and triumphant plunder. Even if the victory over 10 towns was achieved, Beorg knew that he would eventually have to deal with his rival, who would not easily abandon the fervent bloodlust that had put him in power. That was a bridge the king of the tribe of the wolf would have to cross later. The primary issue now was the initial conquest, and if Hiefstag refused to go along, the lesser tribes would split in their alliance among the two. War might be joined as early as the next morning. This would prove devastating to all their people, for even the barbarians who survived the initial battles would be in for a brutal struggle against winter. The reindeer had long since departed for the southern pastures, and the caves along the route had not been stocked in preparation. Hiefstag was a cunning leader. He knew that at this late date the tribes were committed to following the initial plan, but Beorg wondered what terms his rival would impose. Beorg took comfort in the fact that no major conflicts had broken out among the assembled tribes, and this night, when they all met in the common hall, the atmosphere was brotherly and jovial, with every beard in Hengarot lathered in foam. Beorg's gamble had been that the tribes could be united by a common enemy and the promise of continued prosperity. All had gone well, so far. But the brute, Hiefstag, remained the key to it all. The heavy boots of Hiefstag's column shook the ground beneath their determined march. The huge one-eyed king himself led the procession, his great swinging strides indicative of the nomads of the tundra. Intrigued by Beorg's proposal and wary of winter's early onset, the rugged king had chosen to march straight through the cold nights, stopping only for short periods of food and rest. Though primarily known for his ferocious proficiency in battle, Hiefstag was a leader who carefully weighed his every move. The impressive march would add to the initial respect given his people by the warriors of the other tribes, and Hiefstag was quick to pounce on any advantage he could get. Not that he expected any trouble at Hengarot. He held Beorg in high respect. Twice before he had met the king of the tribe of the wolf on the field of honor with no victory to show for it. If Beorg's plan was as promising as it initially seemed, Hiefstag would go along, insisting only on an equal share in the leadership with the blonde king. He didn't care for the notion that the tribesmen, once they had conquered the towns, could end their nomadic lifestyle and be contented with a new life trading knucklehead trout. But he was willing to allow Beorg his fantasies if they delivered to him the thrill of battle and easy victory. Let the plunder be taken and warmth secured for the long winter before he changed the original agreement and redistributed the booty. When the lights of the campfires came into view, the column quickened its pace.
"Sing, my proud warriors," Hiefstag commanded. "Sing hearty and strong. Let those gathered tremble at the approach of the tribe of the elk."
Beorg had an ear cocked for the sound of Hiefstag's arrival. Knowing well the tactics of his rival, he was not surprised in the least when the first notes of the Song of Tempest rolled in from the night. The blonde king reacted at once, leaping onto a table and calling silence to the gathering.
"Hearken, men of the north," he cried. "Behold the challenge of the song!"
Hengarot immediately burst into commotion as the men dashed from their seats and scrambled to join the assembling groups of their respective tribes. Every voice was lifted in the common refrain to the god of battle, singing of deeds of valor and of glorious deaths on the field of honor. This verse was taught to every barbarian boy from the time he could speak his first words, for the Song of Tempest was actually considered a measure of a tribe's strength. The only variance in the words from tribe to tribe was the refrain that identified the singers. Here the warriors sang at crescendo pitch, for the challenge of the song was to determine whose call to the god of battle was most clearly heard by Tempest. Hiefstag led his men right up to the entrance of Hengarot. Inside the hall, the calls of the tribe of the wolf were obviously drowning out the others, but Hiefstag's warriors matched the strength of Beorg's men.
One by one, the lesser tribes fell silent under the dominance of the wolf and the elk. The challenge dragged on between the two remaining tribes for many more minutes, neither willing to relinquish superiority in the eyes of their deity. Inside the Mead Hall, men of the beaten tribes nervously put their hands to their weapons. More than one war had erupted on the plains because the challenge of the song could determine no clear winner. Finally, the flap of the tent opened, admitting Hiefstag's standard-bearer, a youth, tall and proud, with observing eyes that carefully weighed everything about him and belied his age. He put a whalebone horn to his lips and blew a clear note. Simultaneously, according to tradition, both tribes stopped their singing. The standard-bearer walked across the room toward the host king, his eyes never blinking or turning away from Beorg's imposing visage, though Beorg could see that the youth marked the expressions that were upon him. Hiefstag had chosen his herald well, Beorg thought.
"Good King Beorg,"
the standard-bearer began when all commotion had ceased, "and other assembled kings. The tribe of the Elk asks leave to enter Hengarot and share mead with you, that we might join together in toast to Tempus." Beorg studied the herald a bit longer, testing to see if he could shake the youth's composure with an unexpected delay. But the herald did not blink or turn aside his penetrating stare, and the set of his jaw remained firm and confident.
"Granted," answered Beorg, impressed, "and well met."
Then he mumbled under his breath,
"A pity that Hiefstag is not possessed of your patience." "I announce Hiefstag, king of the tribe of the Elk,"
the herald cried out in a clear voice,
"son of Hrothulf the Strong, son of Angar the Brave, thrice killer of the Great Bear, twice conqueror of Termalane to the south, who slew Ragdoning, king of the tribe of the Bear, in single combat in a single stroke."
This drawing uneasy shuffles from the tribe of the Bear, and especially their king, Halfdane, son of Ragdoning. The herald went on for many minutes, listing every deed, every honor, every title accumulated by Hiefstag during his long and illustrious career. As the challenge of the song was competition between the tribes, the listing of titles and feats was a personal competition between men, especially kings, whose valor and strength reflected directly upon their warriors. Beorg had dreaded this moment, for his rival's list exceeded even his own. He knew that one of the reasons Hiefstag had arrived last was so that his list could be presented to all in attendance, men who had heard Beorg's own herald in private audience upon their arrival days before. It was the advantage of a host king to have his list read to every tribe in attendance, while the heralds of visiting kings would only speak to the tribes present upon their immediate arrival. By coming in last, and at a time when all the other tribes would be assembled together, Hiefstag had erased that advantage. At length, the standard-bearer finished and returned across the hall to hold open the tent flap for his king. Hiefstag strode confidently across Hengarot to face Beorg. If men were impressed with Hiefstag's list of valor, they were certainly not disappointed by his appearance. The red-bearded king was nearly 7 feet tall, with a barrel-shaped girth that dwarfed even Beorg's, and Hiefstag wore his battle scars proudly. One of his eyes had been torn out by the antlers of a reindeer, and his left hand was hopelessly crumpled from a fight with a polar bear. The king of the tribe of the Elk had seen more battles than any man on the tundra, and by all appearances he was ready and anxious to fight in many more. The two kings eyed each other sternly, neither blinking or diverting his glance for even a moment.
"The wolf or the elk?"
Hiefstag asked at length, the proper question after an undecided challenge of the song. Beorg was careful to give the appropriate response.
"Well met and well fought," he said. "Let the keen ears of Tempus alone decide, though the god himself will be hard-pressed to make such a choice."
With the formalities properly carried out, the tension eased from Hiefstag's face. He smiled broadly at his rival.
"Well met, Beorg, king of the tribe of the wolf. It does me well to face you and not see my own blood staining the tip of your deadly spear."
Hiefstag's friendly words caught Beorg by surprise. He couldn't have hoped for a better start to the war council. He returned the compliment with equal fervor.
"Nor to duck the sure cut of your cruel axe."
The smile abruptly left Hiefstag's face when he took notice of the dark-haired man at Beorg's side.
"What right, by valor or by blood, does this weakling southerner have in the mead hall of Tempest?"
the red-bearded king demanded.
"His place is with his own, or with the women at best."
"Hold to faith, Hiefstag," Beorg explained. "This is de Bernazon, a man of great import to our victory. Valuable is the information he has brought to me, for he has dwelt in 10 towns for 2 winters and more."
"Then what role does he play?" Hiefstag pressed.
"He has informed,"
Beorg reiterated.
"That is past," said Hiefstag. "What value is he to us now? Certainly he cannot fight beside warriors such as ours."
Beorg cast a glance at de Bernazon, biting back his own contempt for the dog who had betrayed his people in a pitiful attempt to fill his own pockets.
"Plead your case, southerner,"